The following message by Dr. Frank Bateman Stanger was delivered at 10 a.m. on February the 10th, 1972, for the Floyd W. Estes Memorial Service held in Estes Chapel, Asbury Theological Seminary. The message was recorded through the facilities of Asbury Theological Seminary and is now made available to you through the seminary's tape library. Additional copies may be ordered by contacting the tape library and giving complete identification of the message. Ownership privileges must be observed, and this message must not be transcribed without the specific consent of the seminary. Now here is Dr. Stanger giving the Floyd W. Estes Memorial message.
And the swallow to find a nest for her young. Even so, God has given me a nesting place. And where is it? At thy altars. Place. And the swallow to find a nest for her young. Even so, God has given me a nesting place. And where is it? At thy altars. O Lord of hosts. David's nesting place was the house of God. And when he worshipped, he found the same security and the same peace and the same protection that the young of the swallow and of the sparrow find when placed in their nests. And then in this homesickness for the sanctuary, the psalmist cries out, "Oh, the blessed nests." It's a plural word. The many blessednesses of those who dwell in thy house, who praise thee constantly. Then if you look at this same psalm, verses 5 through 8, you'll find that the psalmist takes an imaginative journey to the sanctuary. First of all, he expresses his homesickness. Now he, in his mind and heart, imagines that he's on his way to worship. And all of this points out how he longs for the experience of worship and how dissatisfied he is without it. Oh, the blessednesses of the man whose strength is in thee. The highways of God are in the hearts of such. And here the psalmist is telling us that through worship, God becomes strength to us. And through worship, we become something to God. Our very hearts become the highways of God along which he moves. But says the psalmist, as he anticipates worship, he sees it to be a transforming experience, passing through the valley of tears. They're able to make it a place of springing fountains. And even the early rains cover the grounds with blessings. The psalmist says even more than this. There's an inspiration of anticipated worship which becomes strength. They go from strength to strength. Every one of them shall appear before God in Zion. Why, just to anticipate worship, says the psalmist, gives me a new strength and I can keep on and on and on. I saw this illustrated some years ago. I was in another city. We were traveling downtown from the home where I was staying. And we noticed a lady who was just trudging along the street. And I said to the folks in the car, who is that lady? I said, that's our neighbor. Said she's recently lost her husband. She has a lot of problems and difficulties. I said, do you think we ought to pick her up and take her? Oh, no, they said she'll make it. This is just the way she walks and seemingly her mood. The following morning was Sunday morning. On the way to church, we passed the same lady on her way to church, moving swiftly, with a sprightliness in her walk. And then I remembered what the psalmist said. To anticipate worship gives you strength. They go from strength to strength. Every one of them shall appear before God in Zion. Now, the last section of Psalm 84 really relates to something we're going to say a little later. But this is the psalmist's description of an imaginative arrival at the sanctuary. What happens when we worship? All I'm trying to say this morning very quickly at this point is this, that once a person has an enlightened concept of God and has experienced this God in worship, he never again can be satisfied without continuing experiences of worship. I move now to the third thing I want to say. The heart of worship is an experience of God. I don't care what else happens in a church service. Unless the worshiper becomes aware of God, it is not worship. I don't care how eloquent the preacher is. I don't care what a gift of words he has. I don't care how beautifully the singers sing. Makes no difference whether the sanctuary is packed with standing room only so we can put it in Monday morning's paper. Unless that service gives the worshiper an experience of God, it's not worship. It's a meeting. It's a gathering. It's a rally. Not an experience of people. We evangelicals have made it an experience of the preacher. Who's going to speak in chapel? Well, some of the folks found out this morning. Maybe you've heard or maybe you haven't. I never know about these stories anymore. About the district superintendent that preached in the church on Sunday morning, hardly anybody was there. During the choir number, the district superintendent was quite perturbed that so few had come. And he, in a loud whisper, said to the preacher, "Did you tell him I was coming?" And the preacher whispered back, "I didn't dare." The heart of worship is an experience of God. And this experience of God has got to become real when a man worships. The important thing when we get home isn't to be able to answer what people were there, but the important thing is, was God there? What is worship? The soul thirsting for its counterpart. It's a thirsty land crying out for rain. It's a candle in the act of being kindled. It's a drop of water in quest to the ocean. It's a man listening through a tornado to the still small voice. It's the prodigal son running to his father. It's a soul standing in awe before the mystery of the universe. It's a poet enthralled by the beauty of a sunrise. It's a workman pausing a moment to listen to a strain of music. It's a hungry heart seeking and finding love. It's time flowing into eternity. It's a man climbing the altar stairs to God. James Stewart wrote recently, "It ought not to be possible to conduct a church service in a way which leaves a stranger with the impression that nothing particular is happening and that no important business is at hand." The very purpose of worship is for everybody who comes, including the minister, to have an experience of God. Now, this experience of God in worship has various manifestations. Of course, this could be explored in an entire message, as you know. Sometimes it manifests itself in our conscience. As the late Bishop William Temple said, "To worship is to quicken the conscience by the holiness of God." Sometimes it has a manifestation in our mind. To worship is to feed the mind with the truth of God. Sometimes it has a manifestation in the imagination. To worship is to purge the imagination by the beauty of God. Sometimes it relates to the heart, for worship is to open the heart to the love of God. Sometimes worship manifests itself primarily in the will, for it means to devote the will to the purpose of God. I wish we could realize that the responsibility of a church service is not to tell people how to experience God, but to permit people to experience God. And we make a great mistake in evangelical circles by having one format of worship, one appeal at the end, and then saying that just because people didn't cooperate with a certain format at the end, they didn't meet God that day. We make a great mistake. Just as possible to meet God at any place in the sanctuary as it is at any other place. The important thing is to be at the place in that sanctuary or in the mood in that sanctuary where God becomes the realest thing in the sanctuary. I've reached an age in my spiritual experience where I ask myself the question as I leave every service now, including seminary chapel, and I'll ask it this morning, and it's a pretty heavy responsibility. Did I sense God in any of his manifestations during that particular hour which is devoted to worship? I move to a fourth thing. Man's approach to God in worship is undoubtedly conditioned and colored by his concept of the God whom he worships. A God of holiness will be approached in an attitude of humility and confession. If our God is a God of holiness, we don't enter the sanctuary patting ourselves on the back, throwing our hats in the air and saying to God, first of all and to everybody else, hooray, I'm here. If he's a God of holiness. Holy, holy, holy Lord God Almighty. Never been able to understand why people can go to church and talk and blab all during the prelude if they're trying to sense a God of holiness. I've never been able to understand it. And I haven't found a quiet church in Kentucky. I just don't think we're always mouthing off in the presence of a holy God. Now you can disagree with me, but this is my chance to declare conviction. And you bother me no end when you sit near me in church and talk all the time. You know that you, of course, is generic. Because some of you don't do it. Aren't we trying to get a sense of the holiness of God? A God of mighty works will be approached in a mood of celebration. I think the greatest, now I don't want to throw my musical ability against an expert, but I think the musical rendition of Psalm 150 is one of the most tremendous acts of celebration I know. Why? Because there's the worship of a God of mighty works. A God of love will be approached with eagerness and confidence. Why, when my loved ones come or when I go to my loved ones, I can hardly wait till I get there. Because there's love. And if I'm worshiping a God of love, that kind of love draws me into the presence of love. And if I'm worshiping a God who understands man, and he does through the incarnation, oh, he understands. He understands my tired and aching body last night when I thought I couldn't get ready for chapel. He understands that. He understands my frustrations and my disappointments. He understands my sorrows and my joys. He understands me because of the incarnation. If I'm worshiping a God like this, I can approach him with openness, honesty, and total sincerity in my quest. And so man's approach to God is undoubtedly conditioned and colored by the kind of God he worships. Now, I'll have to be very quick in telling you what I'd hoped I could spend a little more time on. See, it's a proof I'm not prepared. Benjamin Franklin, you know, said, I would have written you a shorter letter if I had had time. And when you and I just go on and on and on, you know what's happened. We've just put everything down, that's it, and then we've gone to preach. Well, take a lesson, many ways to learn. My family says, I'm not learning. Said, this is one of the many drawbacks of older age. You just think everybody wants to hear you endlessly. All right, the final thing I want to say, but don't close your books yet because we're not quite ready to go. The worship experience will be validated in personal experience. You can have the confirmation, you can have the validation that you've worshiped within yourself. That's what I'm trying to say. And I'd like to ask the question, when may I say that I have truly worshiped? Tighten your seat belts. I have 6 answers. I may say I have truly worshiped first when I have a revelation of God. The psalmist said in 27 verse 4 that I may behold the Lord in his beauty. The psalmist in Psalm 48 talked about that I may behold the loving kindness of the Lord. Secondly, I may say that I have truly worshiped when I rest in the Lord. The house of God has been called the mother of the soul. The house of God is a sanctuary, a haven, a refuge. And one of the purposes of worship is to rest. Dr. Sangster said to me one day, I'm learning how to put my whole weight down upon the Lord. Just to rest. Rest in the God of might and majesty. F.W. Faber penned these beautiful lines, then on thy grandeur I will lay me down. Already life is heaven for me. No cradled child more softly lies than I. Rest in the God of holiness. Rest in the God of love. Rest in the God of providence. Rest in the God of history. And when I worship, I learn how to rest in God. Thirdly, I may say I have truly worshiped when I have a revelation from the Lord. Worship gives me a reminder of the divine will at the center of the universe. Psalm 77:13, thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Worship gives me a revelation that clarifies my moral and spiritual perspectives. Psalm 73, you remember the man was worrying, the good man was worrying about the bad man. He said, I couldn't figure it out. Couldn't answer the question. I don't know why evil seems to be rewarded. I don't understand. I can't figure this out. My brain is crazy with trying to figure it out. And then he comes to the climax in verses 16 and 17. When I thought to know this, it was too painful for me. Until I went into the sanctuary of God.
then I understood. Their end. Worship is a wonderful way to get your moral and spiritual perspectives cleansed. And of course, this revelation includes a revelation of God's assignment to us. William Temple wrote, "To seek in worship at once the understanding of our task and the quality by which we may perform it." Fourthly, I may say I have truly worshiped when I respond to God with my whole being. The psalm that I read, verse 4 of the 84th Psalm, talks about continual, uninhibited praise. Everything there is of me just responds to God as He reveals Himself. Fifth, I may say that I have truly worshiped when I sense that I have been renewed by the presence of God. This renewal is cleansing. There's nothing big enough to hold a man's soul in detachment from the center of himself except the majesty of God and His love. And it is in worship, worship given to God because He is God, that man will learn the secret of true humility. But this is also empowerment. And this renewal is also satisfaction. We shall be satisfied with the goodness of thy house. And now we come to that closing section of the 84th Psalm. For there's not only the homesickness for the sanctuary, and not only the imaginative journey to the sanctuary, but there's the imaginative arrival at the sanctuary. What happens when I get there to worship? Ah, says the psalmist, God becomes my shield. What happens when I worship? Life takes on a new quality. I'd rather spend one day in God's house than 1,000 elsewhere. I'd rather sit at the threshold to the house of God than to have a tent of my own and to say it's mine and I can dwell in it forever. What happens when I worship? God becomes not only my shield, but He becomes my son. God gives grace and glory. God gives me the promise that nothing good will be withheld from me. Little wonder is it then that this 84th Psalm closes with that grand and glorious refrain, "Oh, the blessednesses of the man that worships in the house of God." Finally, this is for keeps. I may say that I have truly worshiped when I am inspired to return into the world to do God's will and work. Some churches call the morning worship service divine service. I raise a question that's almost trite. When does divine service begin? It begins after the benediction, during the postlude, when the worshiper retires from the sanctuary back into the world. If you want to see this aspect of the results of true worship, study again the opening verses of Romans 12. Paul's telling us there to do something which is our spiritual worship. And he gives four evidences, and here's your sermon for a week from Sunday if you want it. You've got Sundays done. Present your bodies a living sacrifice. And the word here is all your members. Every part of you. Everything that belongs to you. Just present it all. This is spiritual worship. Be not conformed to this world. This is the result of worship. Prove the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. This is worship. And finally, having gifts that differ, let us use them. them. I can know that I have worshipped ultimately when I'm inspired to return into the world to do God's will and work. This is an unfinished message, except in your life and in mine. May God, through His Spirit, enable us to worship Him in spirit and in truth. The God of peace that brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus, that great shepherd of the sheep through the blood of the everlasting covenant, make you perfect in every good work to do His will, working in you that which is well-pleasing in His sight through Jesus Christ, unto whom be glory forever. Amen.